We prayed with Bill that we'll learn things from the Old Testament that will help us be a shining light to those about us. And I'll tell you, the study of the character of both Ezra and Nehemiah should indeed encourage us to serve God in spite of even those who claim to serve God and their hypocrisy or their disobedience. We saw that in the case of Ezra. We're going to see Nehemiah in his book dealing with problems among his own people as well as those without. And those men indeed stand out because of their faith in God. In the face of opposition and disbelief, their faith rises and becomes an example for us. Okay. In the book of Ezra, we had this basically same material that's on your first page. Let's review for just a moment. You'll note down in the middle of that page, we got three returns from captivity. Hopefully you know that without even looking at the sheet. The first return was under what leader?
Zerubbabel.
And that took place in about when?
536.
That's right. And you'll see a variance in date for a year or two, one way or the other, but around 536 B.C. in the reign of Cyrus, king of Persia. Okay? And where do you read about that first return? Ezra 1 and 2. Okay, and the first six chapters actually deal with it, but if you want to be more focused, as Neil pointed out, chapters 1 and 2, the first six chapters of the book of Ezra deal with why they returned and the fulfilling of that mission, which was what? What was their mission on that first return? A focus of it. What?
Rebuild the temple.
That's right. And that was in the face of opposition and difficulties, but they accomplished that. They returned in 536, but because of the opposition and the things that happened, when did they finally finish it? 516. And 70 years previous, something very important happened. What was it?
Destruction
of the temple. And so you remember Jeremiah talks about 70 years. This is one way the 70 years is dated. There's other way from 605 to 536 when the decree was issued to allow them to return. Or when they actually did the return. Probably the decree, maybe 538 or 7. And so that's another way the 70 years can be calculated. But Jeremiah, previous to Ezra, had already prophesied that period of time. We see that happening. Okay. The second part of the book of Ezra, chapter 7. When do these events take place?
458.
That's the second return. Who's the leader of this one?
Ezra.
That's right. And he came back for what purpose? What?
To teach the law and reform.
Okay, for reforms. He came back. He said he was going to study, practice, and teach the law, right? So he came back for the purpose of religious reform in the nation. Aren't these God's people? Don't they know the law? Haven't they had the law since the time of Moses? Because people have Bible in hand, because they know what the Bible said, doesn't mean they're practicing it. And certainly that was the case in Ezra's time. And so as Bill prayed, we learn things from that. Doesn't do any good to have the Bible in hand unless we practice it. And sometimes we need teaching to motivate us to do what we know we ought to do. So that's the second part of the book of Ezra. In between the sixth chapter and the seventh chapter, there's about 58 years. What important event took place then? The story of Esther. important because had Haman succeeded, he intended to wipe out the Jewish nation, but he failed by the providence of God. All right, so that was the book of Ezra. Now then, in 445, Nehemiah returned. Nehemiah was over in Babylon serving the king, as we'll see. But he heard about the condition of his homeland, and he returned. Not to build the temple, but to build what? They'll build the wall. And that's what the first part of the book of Nehemiah is about, first six chapters. You notice on your sheet we have Nehemiah divided into two sections. First six chapters, you'll see that on page two there, the first six chapters. And then you'll see third return under Nehemiah, building of the wall of Jerusalem. And then chapters 7 through 13, civil and religious reform for the securing of the city, the welfare of the nation. So we'll look at that in that second part. So that's a kind of a basic way to divide the book into two sections. These suggested divisions we have are not written in stone. They're not somewhere in the Bible that says this is the way you got to divide these books. These are just suggestions. You may divide them differently. You may find other people who divide them differently. But they're a way to help us get a handle on the information that's in these sections. And so Nehemiah's return 445 B.C. Okay, so that's one of the things we looked at when we studied Ezra, these three returns. You'll note on your first sheet we have a list of the Persian rulers. We have a time frame there starting in 605. The first deportation when people were taken captive and what notable captives were taken then. The first time?
Daniel
and his friend. That's right. And then in 597 he came again. And then Ezekiel was taken in that second deportation. So you have Daniel and Ezekiel over in Babylon as prophets, Daniel to the kings, Ezekiel to the common people. And then you have the third deportation in 586 when the temple and the city was destroyed. Those are three key dates. Okay? And when you study Daniel and Ezekiel, it'll be helpful to know those dates. And then we have Cyrus, and Cyrus is so important to Ezra because he's the one that issued the decree. And then we get down here now to 445. You see in this list of dates, the third return under Nehemiah. Go all the way to the bottom of your page under Persian rulers. And we see a man that's mentioned in the book of Nehemiah. And this is what helps us put these things in the proper time frame. If you didn't know about the time frames we're talking about when you read, for example, Ezra, you're just reading through the Bible and you don't know about these time frames. You're reading through the Bible and maybe a few weeks later you get to Haggai and Zechariah. What might you think? That's right, that Haggai and Zechariah happened after the book of Ezra and after the book of Nehemiah. But that's not so, is it? Haggai and Zechariah prophesied during the time that we read about in the book of Ezra, the first part. And then we get here in Nehemiah, we got this king Artaxerxes. And that's mentioned right here in chapter 2, chapter 1, verse 1, the 20th year. And then he explains in chapter 2, verse 1, it's the 20th year of the king Artaxerxes. So here we have his reign, 464 to 463. So that's how we come up with the 445 in the 20th year. And so we get that date of that third return from that. Okay? And so this is the Artaxerxes that's called, as you see on your sheet, Longinus. You don't have to remember that. Not important to us. But just to identify him from other kings with that name. Okay? Now look at your second page of your introduction. The author That was a hard question. I know you had to work on that probably 30 minutes, right? Obviously, the author is Nehemiah. He says in 1:1 the words of Nehemiah, but then also you have these I sections all the way through the book. I don't have it on your sheet, but you might want to write it on your sheet. First of all, before I do that, note 1:1, the words of Nehemiah. Now it happened in the month Kislev in the 20th year while I was in Susa the capital. So there you identify who the I is right there. But now look at chapter 5, verse 14. This will help explain these other verses I have on your sheet. I should have put this verse on there as well, and it is now the edited copy that I'll upload. But in 5:14, moreover, from the day that I was appointed to be their governor in the land of Judah. And so, chapter 1:1, I is Nehemiah. I was appointed to be their governor, 5:14. And these other three verses that I have here state clearly that Nehemiah is the governor. So he was appointed as a ruler in the Persian government over this district or province over here in Judah. And he is the author of the book. All right, we have a second question. About how many years does the book of Nehemiah span? We start in chapter 2, verse 1 with the 20th year of Artaxerxes. Go to chapter 5:14 again. And you have almost your answer there. It's close. From the 20th year to the 32nd year, that's 12 years. But there's another little part to this answer, and that's found over in this last verse that I gave you, in chapter 13 and verse 6. What else do you have to add? What other time note is found in chapter 13, verse 6, right toward the end?
Then it says, certain days he obtained leave of the king.
Okay. You're reading what, the King James?
Yes, sir.
Okay, this says after some time or certain days. In other words, there's another time element involved. How long? Don't know. 32nd year return, but then he came back again to Judah. How long was that span? Don't know. So 12 plus years, all the best I can do with that, that the book of Nehemiah spans. Okay, so if Nehemiah came back in 445 and his work spanned 12 plus years, that brings you down to when? 332, 3. Now, when the book of Malachi was written, they had governors. He does not mention Nehemiah, however, by name. Malachi is not only the last Old Testament book, but it's thought to be the last Old Testament prophet. And so if there were governors in Malachi's writing, when there were governors, and he doesn't even mention Nehemiah, it's thought that his work followed Nehemiah. The canon closed about 400 B.C., so that gives you a way to kind of date Malachi. Just somewhere in the early 400s B.C. And so, again, that may be helpful in putting the things that happen in your Bible in the proper perspective. Okay, this next exercise we have is a pretty simple one. It takes a little bit of work, not too bad. It's just going through the book to try to get a handle on the book so that we're in a chapter, we kind of have an idea what this section is about. It's helpful in getting an overall view of the book, but it's also helpful in doing what we often talk about, and that is context, being sure that we interpret verses in their context. And so what we have here is just to try to break down the chapters a little bit more and get a hold on what's in those chapters. So we start with chapter 1. I've given you the first three verses, Nehemiah's inquiry about Jerusalem. What did you put on Nehemiah 1:4 through 11? Nehemiah's prayer. And Nehemiah was evidently a man of prayer. You find that throughout the book, and we'll talk about his prayer. Very interesting prayer that you'll read here in the rest of the chapter. It raises the question, when we see issues that concern us, as Nehemiah was so concerned, is prayer an option for us? Nehemiah went to God in prayer, and the nature of his prayer, we have that on your first lesson on chapter 1, that is, to break down those sections, very interesting, his prayer, what it consisted of. And then 2, 1 through 8, Nehemiah's appeal to
Artaxerxes,
to the king, to do what? Let him go back and rebuild the wall. That's right. And so he made this appeal to Artaxerxes, the king. And verse 5, it says, if it please the king, if your servant has found favor before you, send me to Judah, to the city of my father's tombs, that I may rebuild it. Verse 8 is more specific, where you see that he talks about the wall and the rebuilding of the wall. So let's go back to rebuild the city, that is the wall around the city. In those days, a city had walls for protection. If it had no walls, it was completely exposed. And so here the city had had the temple rebuilt, but all around it just lay in ruins. And so we're talking about 445. How long had those ruins been there? Approximately. How long? How long when these people went to the temple? The temple is rebuilt, right? It's in the city, correct? So it's time to go to the temple to worship. You start up to the temple, there's no walls. There's rubble, there's stones all over the place. Things are in disrepair. How long had that been going on?
100 years.
Okay, the temple was destroyed in 586, so for 130 years they laid there. Of course, the people didn't come back to 536. So, was that 80 years? And nothing's done. We can get comfortable with things that we need to address. And that's certainly evidently what had happened. And there's other extenuating factors, the opposition they had faced, the letter that had been written to Artaxerxes by their enemies. We read about that in Ezra chapter 4. Apparently previous to the time of Nehemiah, where Artaxerxes had actually issued an edict to stop any work that was being done on the city. And so Nehemiah appeals to the king now to go and return and rebuild the walls of the city. You wonder, why hasn't this occurred to anybody else? Any of the other governors, Zerubbabel and those that followed him, any of the leading men? I don't know. Maybe those people have the same problem we sometimes do. I hope somebody tackles that. Instead of, here's a job to be done, I'll tackle it. I'll take care of it. But anyway, for whatever the reason was, that's what we find. All right, chapter 2, 9 through 16, what do we have? What?
Nehemiah inspects the temple.
Okay, he goes back to Jerusalem. He looks at the city, goes around the walls and inspects. So the journey to Jerusalem and survey of the city is the way I put it. You can put it however you want. You can actually divide that in two parts, the journey to Jerusalem and then the survey of the city. Interesting that he went out at night to survey the wall, didn't tell anybody about it. We'll see more about that later. And so that's what you have in the rest of chapter 2. You'll note in, we'll take note of this a little further when we get into chapter 2, a little statement in verse 12. He said, what God was putting in my mind. Remember that little phrase. So when you study chapter 2, you ask the question, how was God putting this in his mind? Okay, so that's just an interesting thing to observe there. All right, now in chapter 2, 17 through 20, without this, the wall would not have gotten built. Resolution to build, right? Resolution to build. You see this in verse 17, let us rebuild the wall. And then you see, even though there was opposition from Sanballat and Tobiah, verse 19, you see this determination, this resolution. He didn't let somebody's objections, threats, or whatever it may be, stop him. He says in verse 20, we his servants will arise and build. Would to God we had that kind of resolution. When Barnabas, some of you may remember this from the book of Acts, when the church at Antioch was established, remember those who had been dispersed went about preaching, and one of the places they went was Antioch, and some Christians were made there. Jerusalem heard about it, and they sent Barnabas down there. Does anybody remember what the text says Barnabas encouraged them to do? All right, look at Acts 14. It won't help you to look at Acts 14 because it's in chapter 11. Look in Acts chapter 11. Verse 23. If you have the New American Standard, how does it read? What did he encourage them to do?
With a resolute heart,
determination, resolution. That's the way things get done. Not happenstance, maybe. And the way this wall got built was because a man said, we're going to do it. Resolution, determination. If you're in a business, that's how things get done in a business, isn't it? You have a business plan, you execute it. Doesn't do any good, just talk about it. And so here's a resolution to build, and it's through the influence and determination of Nehemiah, a leader among the people, that the work got done. Now, chapter 3 is a real interesting chapter. We have the progress of the work. We'll talk about that. We've got some questions on your sheets about that. If you'll answer those questions, I think you'll find it interesting as to why this work progressed like it did, and you'll find it interesting as to who did not help in the building of the wall. I found that very interesting. And so you may want to take a text of Nehemiah, you may want to print it off if you don't want to mark in your Bible, and then go through chapter 3 and mark the locations that are being mentioned there, because it kind of tracks the progress of the rebuilding of the wall there in chapter 3. Chapter 4, I just labeled it opposition. And you read about a couple fellows that we read about in chapter 2 that were prominent. They're not the only ones, but prominent in their opposition to the work that was going on. One was by the name Sanballat, verse 1, and the other in verse 3, Tobiah. And they're opposing the work that is being done, and we'll talk about how they endeavored to do that. You'll note in verse 5, Nehemiah says they are demoralizing the builders in the New American Standard Version. Other versions read different there. But that's certainly what the chapter is about, that they opposed the work and tried to get the work to stop. And we'll see the defense measures, the things that Nehemiah did to thwart their efforts of opposition. You know, it's bad enough when you got to fight those on the outside, but what happens when you got problems on the inside? And it's interesting, you read chapter 3, and I think it's a remarkable chapter about who got their hands dirty in its work. But then you get to chapter 5, and evidently some of these same people are oppressing their own people. Not the folk, not Tobiah and Sanballat, but internal oppression. And this When Nehemiah found out about this, he became very angry. He addressed the situation. The men were cooperative. And in contrast to what was being done, he talked about his role as governor and that he never used that for personal gain the time that he was there. You'll see that at the end of chapter 5. Chapter 6, we have attempts to ensnare Nehemiah. And in the middle of that section, we have a subsection. What's 6:15 through 16? Wall is finished. How many days? I know I didn't ask you that. That's on a later class, but you may remember. 52 days. Isn't that amazing? Been laying there for 130 years. They've been back 80 years in less than 2 months. Less than 2 months. Because of the resolution of a leader and people willing to cooperate and work together, they were able to get it done. Bill talked about lessons from the Old Testament. Boy, this is a lesson for us. All right, the second part of the book, chapter 7 through 13. What did they endeavor to secure? First four verses.
Organization of Jerusalem.
That's a good way to put it, organization of Jerusalem. And why would they do that? To secure the city. They're trying to secure the city. He could see that there are problems with these gates being open and not many people in the city, and he addresses that in another chapter. And so we need to take some measures here to secure the city. Remember that walls were a protection and the gates were a protection. And so they didn't have airplanes and those kind of things. And so walls were a great detriment to people conquering the city. That's why the story of Jericho is so significant. They had walls so big around Jericho they could build houses on them. Remember Rahab? And so how are these soldiers going to get in that city? Well, there's our story, the walls of Jericho falling down. God says, here, I'll take their defense away, their security away. And so here are measures to secure. They've got the walls down, but yet measures need to be taken to secure the city. In verse 5 through 73, we have a list like we did in Ezra 2 of those who returned under Zerubbabel. And then in chapter 8, 1 through 15, what did you put for that? All right, the reading of the law, public reading of the law. Everybody gathered there at the water gate, and that's one of the gates of the wall, and the law was read publicly. Is there a value in reading the Word of God? Evidently, they thought so. Is there a value in people of any age listening attentively to the proper reading of the law and then having it explained? That's what we're going to read in chapter 8. That's what took place. And it's interesting, the result of that. Okay, so that's 1 through 15. I've actually on my sheet changed this. 1 through 15 is where I got it. And then 16 through 18, I've actually changed this on mine. Made that 1 through 12. You do it however you wish. Again, like I told you, it's not written in stone. But beginning in 13, or if you want to stay with the way I got it, 16, what happens? The feast of, which feast is it? Booths or tabernacles happen in the fall. And so they found when they read that about this feast. And so they observed that feast. You'll note in chapter 8, verse 2, is the first day of the seventh month.
And they read the law, and this feast occurred in the seventh month. It's a week-long feast, and they went out and observed this feast. And then in chapter 9, a day of doing what? First three verses. What?
Confession and worship
is a good way to put it. I put fasting and confession. You note verse 1, they assembled with fasting. And then they confessed and worshiped. So that's a good answer, verse 3, confession and worship. Good answer. And then verse 4 through 38, the prayer of the Levites. And then chapter 10. What do you have in chapter 10?
Covenant of the leaders.
Look at 9:38. Now, because of all this, we're making an agreement. What is a covenant? Isn't that what it is? We're making an agreement in writing on the sealed document are the names of our leaders, our Levites and our priests. Now, on the sealed document were. And it tells whose names were on it. So they make a covenant. We'll look at that when we get to chapter 10, the Lord willing. Now, we read about, back in chapter 7, he was concerned because there weren't many people in the city. And so, when you get to chapter 11, 1 through 24, you see efforts made here to get people to move into the city, to raise the population of the city. This goes along with chapter 7 there and the idea of securing the city. And then in 11:25 through 36, he lists the cities that they lived in outside there of Jerusalem. All right, then in 12, 1 through 43, you have another list of who? Priests and Levites who returned with Zerubbabel. And then 12:44 through the end of the book are religious reforms. Some of the same kind of reforms that Ezra had to work on, weren't they? And so you think, well, it hadn't been that long. In fact, Ezra and Nehemiah are contemporary for part of the time. And yet you see people falling back into these bad habits. And Nehemiah working on that. Things like intermarriage. We'll see that when we get to that part of our study. Any other comments before we get into chapter 1? Okay, that's kind of a rundown, introduction to the book, Nehemiah. Let's start here in chapter 1. You'll note I've got some observations, and you can read these verses. I trust hopefully you have. If you haven't, you can read those when you get home. They're all about Nehemiah, just kind of some general observations about Nehemiah. And you really come to appreciate these two men in these two books, Ezra and Nehemiah, just like you come to appreciate Esther and Mordecai when you read that book. And so, you know, the New Testament says that the Old Testament provides us examples for warning and for encouragement. And you see in these men certainly examples for encouragement. All right, we see Nehemiah's concern. And we note here, I said at the end of this section, on number 2, these characteristics of Nehemiah are seen throughout the book, not only in chapters 1 and 2. As we go through Nehemiah, you can add corresponding references beside A, B, C, and D. So like on A there, Nehemiah's concern, I don't know if you wrote anything, but like I jotted out in that note in that in my space after that, chapter 1, verse 2, Nehemiah's concern. It says, Hanani, one of my brothers and some men from Judah came, and I asked them concerning the Jews who had escaped and had survived the captivity and about Jerusalem. Why does he care? He's over in Babylon, but he's got a high position of honor. We see that when Joseph became, when you see the cupbearer back there, exalted, it says, to a position of honor, according to Joseph's dream. And you see Daniel and his three friends who were brought into the service of the king, which was a very high position of honor. And so Nehemiah's got it pretty good. He don't have to get out and evidently do difficult work to maintain a living. He's in a secure place here with the king. Got a comfortable life. Why is he concerned about those fellows back there? And so, but this is Nehemiah. He's not just looking at his ease, his well-being. He's concerned about his brethren and their welfare. And we'll talk more about that as we go through chapter 1 and 2. Why is he so concerned about the city of his fathers? You know, I don't care about the city where I was born. It doesn't make me a whole lot of difference. I don't have any particular ties there. Why is Nehemiah so concerned about the city of his fathers? My folks came from Louisiana. Should I be concerned about Louisiana? what's the connection? And yet you do see Nehemiah's concern. So I put chapter 1, verse 2. I put chapter 1, verse 10. He's concerned about his the people who God redeemed. These are your people, Lord. You redeemed them by your great hand. And I'm concerned about them. Concerned about their welfare. You see in chapter 2 and verse 3, why should my face not be sad when the city, the place of my father's tomb, lies desolate? Its gates have been consumed by fire. And then you see again in verse 12, God was putting in my mind something to do for Jerusalem. And so he had in his mind to do something about this city. He's concerned about it. God is the one, he said, that stirred him up to have that kind of thinking. Okay, and then, so we see Nehemiah's selflessness, willing to give up his easy position. And I told you 2:17 is also in that first point on Nehemiah's concern, where he says, you see the bad situation we're in. So there it expresses his concern. And Nehemiah's selflessness. Willing to give up his easy position for a task requiring toil and trouble. We've already looked at chapter 1, verse 4, where when he heard about it, he sat down and wept and mourned. We actually looked at verse 3, but here you see he mourned about it, prayed about it, fasted about it. Why not just say, oh, well, that's just too bad. But no, he's not just thinking of how easy it is. He's willing to think about doing something that's going to expose him to difficulty. You know, you wonder if Nehemiah learned when these guys came back about the previous decree of Artaxerxes that you read about in Ezra chapter 4. You remember Artaxerxes had already issued a decree, quit any building of this city. I'll stop it with force of arms if necessary. Maybe he learned about that when these guys came back. I don't know. But if that's the case, what's going to be the king's attitude? What kind of peril might he expose himself to just to even approach the king about it? But he's willing to take that risk because he's not thinking just of Nehemiah. And then Nehemiah's faith. He goes to God in prayer asking God may grant favor in King Artaxerxes' sight. What does King Artaxerxes care about Jerusalem anyway? We already saw he wrote an edict saying stop the building of the city. We learned about that in Ezra 4. And yet, in chapter 1, 5, I beseech you, Lord God of heaven, the great and awesome God who preserves covenant and loving kindness for those who love him and keep his commandments. You see his faith in God's care for his people. It, verse 8, he said, that, I remember what you said, God. You said, if you're unfaithful, I'll scatter you, but if you return and keep my commandments, then I'll gather you and bless you. Faith in God's promises. You see that in the case of Nehemiah. And so in verse 11, here's an interesting prayer. He said, make your servant successful today in granting compassion before this man. Does it take faith to pray that? Indeed it does. And when you get over to chapter 2, you see verse 4 when the king said, what's wrong, Nehemiah? What do you want? What did he do? He prayed. He turned to the source that he could, thought he could find some help. At the end of verse 8, you find a phrase that, like me in the book of Ezra, this is a phrase that you're going to find throughout the book. Maybe not these exact words, but this idea of the providence of God. Look at the end of verse 8. The good hand of my God was upon me. Nehemiah believes that the prosperity or the success of his work is by the power of God. And then when you get to verse 18, the hand of my God had been favorable to me. And then in verse 20, opposition has already reared its ugly head, but look what he said. Look at his faith. The God of heaven will give us success. How do you know? He trusts God, trusts his promises, trusts his grace and compassion. We'll see that in his prayer. And then we already talked about Nehemiah's determination in chapter 2, 17 and 20. In spite of opposition and difficulties, he determined to accomplish his mission. Okay, the Lord willing, in our class on Wednesday, we'll pick up with chapter 1, get actually into the chapter, particularly verses 4 through 11. Again, if you don't have the lessons, they're on the back, or you can download them from the website. Thank you very much.